Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably.
We're going to have a fun time today on the Media Project. I tell you, that's a promise, and you will be here to hear it all. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, with my fine colleagues, Ira Fussfeld, former publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Hello, good afternoon,
sir.
Good morning, good night.
Great to see you. And Dr. Alan Shartok, columnist, commentator, professor emeritus, and the guy who runs Northeast Public Radio. Here he is.
Hello.
Good day to you as well, of course. And so we start with one of your friends, Alan, because he writes in, Jeff from Saratoga Springs writes in and says, I am sick of the press. That's what he says. So there you go. He's sick of the press specifically for complaining about Trump. And he says he's tired of the press for two reasons after watching the presidential debates. He says, one, they are kingmakers. In the past, they were much fairer to lesser candidates, or at least tried to portray themselves as fair. Now they just blatantly ignore them and set up the rules of the debates so they only get a tiny fraction of airtime. That is, he's thinking about like when Jim Webb is running or Lincoln Chafee. I guess they didn't get a chance to speak. And on the Republican side, the same thing. So what do you think about that?
Boy, you're looking to me. I was going to defer to the political scientists. I'm on record as saying that this is a and maybe we say this every time there's a presidential election, but I just think this has not been one of the press's finest moments in how this campaign and this primary season has been covered. I think that they've allowed Trump to dictate to them, many of them, particularly the broadcast cable networks, how the rules of engagement are to be. I think that in general, it's just leaving a bad taste in my mouth. I don't know whether the public is being well served, but I'm not sure immediately how I would say to do it otherwise. Bearing in mind that they've made the calculation that, using Trump as an example, he's bringing in listeners and viewers, and they need the listeners and viewers to compete and to make money. But I just think, generally speaking, this has not been a proud presidential campaign season for the media.
Our writer actually has a suggestion. He says that the FCC should set up rules for the debates and make it mandatory with no commercial interruptions or advertising, move from network to network so that the moderators are diverse, and that the set in stone for who gets invited to the debates, placement as well as questions should be drawn randomly. He wants, in effect, less control by the media and more set in place, I guess, by the government, by the FCC, to do these debates. So
I don't see the media controlling the debates. Aren't the political parties controlling the debates? Yes, the media outlets are choosing their own moderators, but we've already seen two different networks chastised for which moderators they use. The parties are scheduling and awarding the debates to various networks. So in other words, a lot of it is not within the control of the media.
Well, Ira, let me put it this way. I think Jeff is correct in his assumption that the media has a part in this, and he can be sick of them. But, I was just talking to somebody, a reporter, a very good one, who said that the awarding of Hillary winning in
Iowa, that's what you're trying to say.
That's right. Mm-hmm. You're so right, Rex. Out in Iowa. A little tired because of fun drivitis.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is, he won by, 2%? Tenths of a percentage point. And I said that to her, and she said, no, it was 3/10 of a percentage point that she won by. So, I think what happens is that he's right in that the press has a certain arrogance and the pundits in awarding who they like the wins in this case. And I think that the press is part of a larger sociological phenomena known as America. And they play a role just like the Putin press plays a role in Russia. Now, there's some diversity within the press, but in the end, the analysis of what has happened falls to the press, and I think they fail.
So Hillary did not win in Iowa. I thought that most of the coverage actually said that it was basically a tie. There was the Democratic Party of Iowa that called it a win.
But
she did get like three delegates more, four delegates more.
But she stood up there and she raised her hands, Rocky style, over her head and say, "We won."
Well, that's her.
Well,
you know,
no,
so we're not supposed to cover that, right?
Well, you know, this coverage.
It's so easy to blame the press for, you know, portraying things as they are when you don't like them because, you know, you're a supporter of Bernie. So there you go.
Now, there's no reason to be defensive here. but the fact of the matter is that Hillary raising her hands over her head became a big part of the evening news. So you're right. If it's in the written press, which most people don't read anymore, you know, it's
a shot.
Except for the millions who read the written press on the internet.
That was a shot. No question about it.
Yeah. A lot more people get their news from print than from radio, by the way.
Yes.
Just FYI, if you want to take shots.
Yeah, but the people who get their news from people like WAMC here, where we're broadcasting from right now, they are the smartest people in the world. This isn't for everybody.
Let the record show he's saying that with a straight face.
Okay. CNN was up 40% in prime time in January, due not only to their coverage of the presidential race, but also to their town hall, the State of the Union address. Everybody, all the cable channels are claiming some victory here. MSNBC, which is in third place, had the most total growth of all the cable news operations because of Rachel Maddow coming on very strong. And actually, your favorite show, Alan, Morning Joe, topped CNN's New Day. So isn't that interesting?
That is interesting. As things get tougher, closer, people, you know, when it's relevant, people will tune in to find out what's going on. And Morning Joe has a good pattern. We have a better actual morning show here at WAMC called The Roundtable. And the first hour of The Roundtable has a roundtable panel with some really, really smart people. See, because I'm not a big fan of Joe Scarborough. I think he's...
too conservative for you.
No, it's just not. And that's a little too dismissive. It's that he's not smart enough.
If Joe Scarborough was to his former life as a Republican congressman, exactly, and he ran for president today, the press would consider him one of the more moderate Republicans.
Yeah.
He has expressed on more than one occasion disdain for some Republican points of view, which you don't hear from the base that veteran.
The reason for that is that he has a job.
Well,
and he's running a show, and it's on MSNBC, which everybody sort of acknowledges is the sort of lefty station of the various news stations. And you know, he knows that there are parameters that he has to operate within. So, Ira, with all deference and respect to you, I don't agree with a word you're saying.
Well, there you go.
Well, where's that comment about slapping him around? Or did we talk about that off the air? I forget.
I always tell people that one of these days, what the sound they're going to hear on the air in the show is going to be it's me reaching across the microphone to strangle the man. But no, I don't. I say that with all the love in my heart.
And nobody knows that. And nobody knows that better than I do.
Right? It's all a good thing. So if you would like to be a part of this program, share your views. media@wamc.org is our email address. Media.
By the way, speaking about Hillary claiming victory with the slimmest of margins and championing the victory. After this program, depending on where you hear it, people are going to switch over and watch the Super Bowl. If one team dominates the other and the other one just happens to squeak out a one-point victory, they're going to be celebrated. I mean, at the end of the day, Hillary won that election, albeit very slimly, but she won it.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't disagree with you more.
So
it was a tie.
It was a tie.
And that, I think, goes right to Jeff's point about
really?
That's
a media issue?
Yeah, because, in other words, here's Ira, a very respected and important guy, had been the publisher of the Kingston Freeman, and, you know, largely responsible for the editorial policy and the rest of it. And he says Hillary won. Well, she won with, what, 0.3%? Now, come on, it was a tie. So if one side says it was a tie, the other one says it was she won, the Ira side said she won. In fact, you know, and that bias is the way people think.
Here's a piece that you might want to chew on while you're talking about it, and that is the media determining after the Iowa votes that it is, in the words of both the Washington Post and CNBC and the National Journal, the beginning of the end of Donald Trump, all used that term. So here's the guy who came in second. I guess, Alan, you wouldn't say Would you say that he lost, or is that not losing? Or did he actually come in third because he was only 1 point ahead of the guy who came in third?
Oh, sharper than a serpent's
tooth. So whatever he, whatever order he came in, is there some question as to whether it's appropriate then for these headlines to be saying, is this the beginning of the end of Donald Trump? Or if you're Donald Trump, are you then being treated unfairly by the media?
Well, I don't know. You know, I read the New York Times analysis, which was profound, of all of these elections. And, you know, for the most part, I acknowledge the people at the Times editorial board. They went to Harvard and Yale, places like that. They're very bright people. I just had no idea what the hell they were talking about. They were saying, is this the beginning of the end? They don't like Trump. And I think the analysis points out they don't like Trump.
So nobody likes Trump, apparently, because I was saying that's also in CNBC, the National Journal, the Washington Post, Dana
right.
Milbank, you know, all these people.
Well, the problem is
but
not
that's true, Rexy. That mm-hmm. is true. They don't like Trump. He is not part of the Republican establishment. They don't want him. They want Rubio now. They're coalescing around Rubio. They certainly don't want Trump, and they certainly don't want Cruz.
Who doesn't? The media?
The Republican establishment.
Oh, the Republican establishment.
That's
sure.
Right. And therefore, you know, that's what you're going to see. Look, I do think that the original letter writer, Jeff, had it exactly right, that the words that come out, the New York Times analysis, I thought was severely flawed. Really did.
Severely flawed in that it...
In that is this the end? Is this the end for Bernie or whatever else? You know, I think that...
So they shouldn't do analysis, or should they do analysis that agrees with your point of view?
Well, you see, there you go again, Rex.
Well,
you're sort of
just trying to figure out what you're
cynical,
saying.
Sardonic things that you are prone to say.
Uh-huh.
Well, the problem is not that they're saying this is the beginning of the end for Trump. The problem is that they've been saying it, this is the beginning of the end for Trump for about 6 months.
Yeah.
And each time they think each time he does something or performs in a way that would historically eliminate a candidate, he overcomes it and in many respects, at least according to various polls, gets more popular. So, you know, I think it's a fair conclusion to reach after Iowa that this is the beginning of the end of Trump because his polling was much more favorable and he wound up finishing second.
So let's see what happens.
So we'll see what happens.
So let's see what happens. We go to South Carolina.
Certainly shows the weakness of polling, doesn't it? Because all the polls were saying that
he
was
going to
win.
Well, also in a caucus. You know, caucus system, which I still don't understand, to be perfectly honest with you.
Well.
It's very difficult and to poll in those situations. But now we're going to be going to Super Tuesday. We're going to be going to South Carolina. Let's just see what happens here. Now, look, I'm not a Trump person, but I got to tell you, I have learned, as Ira has just intimated, that a lot of people have counted him out for way too long.
Before we leave the presidential race, we should make note of a Columbia Journalism Review article that talked about the term socialist applied to Bernie Sanders. You know, he calls himself a democratic socialist. And the media, the reporters are trying to explain that to people, what that means, without a great deal of success. It's really one of those difficult things to define, in part difficult because for years, for decades in this country, that word was considered anathema. You know, it was a bugaboo to be a socialist. And now we've got a guy who is a leading candidate for president who has always throughout his career described himself as that. And so in trying to describe what it means, it's been very difficult.
Well, isn't he qualifying it? Have you, before this last couple of months, Alan, you've interviewed him. Have you ever heard him describe himself as a democratic socialist, which is what he does
well,
now?
I think the emphasis there. I want to point out to both of you, if I may, and to our audience, that gay rights weren't going to happen in America. Wasn't going to happen. Gay marriage, an anathema to too many people. Then all of a sudden, we had this incredible push from whom? The people who were coming up, the younger people in this country. And all of a sudden, state legislatures were passing this. Courts were saying it. I'm saying that with Bernie's message, which is quite clear and quite correct, that a few people own all of it, and that that's wrong, that the word socialism and democratic socialism may, in fact, be transferable in the same way that the concept of gay marriage and gay rights, which really caught a lot of pundits and others not knowing what they were talking about. It happened, and it happened fast. I think it may happen here.
It could be. It's a It's an odd situation, though, that we really don't have a clear definition of what it means, as opposed to being, you know, he and the CJR article basically concludes that he's the one who fuzzes it up, because he describes it more as being in the tradition of Franklin Roosevelt, Medicare, Social Security, that sort of thing.
Public libraries.
So you maybe know, that's it. Maybe you know, that's what socialism is. He sort of defines socialism through an example of what it's not. So it's interesting. It's a proactive, robust government. That sounds like what the Democratic Party has always stood for.
You know, Rexy, that during the JFK election, what was the one thing that we thought couldn't happen, that a Catholic could be elected president of the United mm-hmm. States? Catholic? I had an aunt who used to tell me, I'm not going to vote for him, he'll be taking orders from the Pope of Rome.
I remember hearing that, yeah.
And we heard it all over the place. And he gets up and he gives this definitive, defining speech, right?
Which is not relevant, he said.
Yeah, and sets everybody's mind at ease, and he wins the election.
So, again, if you want to share your thoughts, media@wamca.org, Alan Shartuck, Ira Fussfeld, and Rex Smith here for you on the Media Project from Albany, New York. We need to talk a little bit about sports media, which is where Ira began his career. It is an interesting issue, what has been said about Jeff Van Gundy, who is a color commentator now on ESPN, former coach, came out during one of the games recently and talked about the quid pro quo and the extensive use of unnamed sources in sports reporting right now to supposedly give you the inside the locker room report. All of this stuff coming without attribution. And it does seem to me as though there is a different standard in sports journalism than there is in the rest of the media, that you can just say, well, this coach got fired because he doesn't get along with his players or something like that. Is that, Ira, you think that's
true? I think that if there is a different standard, and I'm not sure there is, there shouldn't be. You know, this just transcends sports. We've learned, particularly over the last dozen or so years, as the press has become less trusted by the public, that the public does not like reading or hearing from unnamed sources. They distrust the publication or the broadcast outlet. They feel that they are making these things up. And by and large, the news organizations, certainly on the press side, agree that it's not a good practice to have unnamed sources, and try very hard, I think you see less of them. Now,
I don't agree with that, Ira. Well, I just want you to know. I'm not talking about sports.
Yeah, you think it's getting worse?
I think it's getting
worse. See, I don't think it's getting worse.
I think it's a virus. I think it gets in reporters, and they get away with it, and it's, you know, it becomes...
Rex is still on the ground. I know Rex, and I respect Rex's policy. They try to avoid unnamed sources, but when it's unavoidable, they'll use them. But they certainly won't use them without having discussed it with people above the reporter level.
New York Times regularly now says, would not, as if this is going to make it all right, regularly says, didn't want to give their name because they have something to do with it.
Because they're not authorized to do so.
Not authorized.
Or something
who are they fooling? They're still allowing it, lot of unnamed sources.
They are, but that doesn't mean that it's anonymous to the editors. It means that this is important information that you wouldn't have otherwise, and so you always make a balancing judgment. You make a thoughtful judgment as an editor. Are we going to allow this story in the paper, even though it doesn't have a named source? Because we trust who the source is, because we believe that there is legitimacy to what's being said, and because we think this information is important.
Rexy, I've never understood something. You work at the Albany Times Union, and there is a former editor, Harry Rosenfeld, who happened to be one of the key people in the Watergate scandal, and he was the Metropolitan editor. Or whatever.
Yeah, he was called and assistant Woodward managing editor Metropolitan during Watergate.
At the Washington Post. He wasn't involved in the scandal.
But Woodward and Bernstein reported to him.
Yeah, he hired Woodward.
And all along, we assumed that the rule was, because nobody knew who Deep Throat was then, we now know who it was, that he was being informed. And after the fact, he said he didn't know.
He didn't, but that doesn't mean that Ben Bradley didn't know.
I see.
You know,
you
it doesn't.
The top man.
Yeah, Ben Bradley was the editor of the Post.
You think is there some sense that he did know?
Yeah.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm intrigued. You read the news pages probably more closely than I do.
Certainly.
I don't think that the number of unknown sources has increased. I think it's decreased. You're saying otherwise.
Well, I tell you, I think, for example, when I read it day after day after day in the New York Times, that not for attribution because of this, because of that. At least in my flawed memory, I don't remember all of that happening for all of those years with the Times.
Well, at the end of the day, you going back to the sports article, if the reporter in the locker room is getting information from someone whose name they don't want to attach their name, and that's the only way the story can get in the paper, the reporter has to make a judgment. Do I trust this source? Is what he's telling me accurate? And is it so important that it needs to get in, even though it's unnamed? And I would venture to say I certainly hope that those calculations are being made.
But Ira, reporters need stories.
And
they want those stories, and they want to get the credit for having those stories and for finding material that otherwise wouldn't be available. So how do we know that they're not being prejudiced because they're so anxious to please their editors by getting new material?
Well, if they're making this stuff up out of whole cloth, they're not going to be around very long.
Yeah, I don't think that. Of course, they want good stories, but they want to tell good stories because they're important, because they're committed to doing what journalist does, which is shine a spotlight on things that need to be illuminated. And sometimes the only way you can get an important story across is by using unnamed sources, because you don't often have documents. You know, we've been watching, we've seen recently this great movie Spotlight featuring the work of the Boston Globe in exposing the priest sex abuse scandal that rocked the world. And that was done through hard digging and through finding source material, tracking names of where priests were at what time. But it also involved, by the way, unnamed sources. They did not name the victims, and nor should they have. So if you were to have only the rule that you shouldn't publish unless you're using the names of sources, a lot of that just wouldn't have gotten out. So.
I think the public, and I'm the public. There's one columnist in a New York City paper who almost always has these hot stories that he purports to be breaking, and almost never is the source attributed to it. Now, when I read that week after week after week after week, at some point in time I'm saying, can he get anybody to get on the record?
Nobody will ever go on the record with him.
And
right.
Then that puts his column and his information in doubt in my mind.
And that's actually one of the perils of using unnamed sources. People begin to assume that they can get away without it, without telling you that. And our instruction...
Meantime, that guy who I think I know who you were referring to, as it does everybody, has been there for a long time. And he's liked by his boss at the place.
Leads me to wonder if he, in fact, is reporting those sources to his bosses and they are satisfied that he is printing legitimate information, or if they're just...
I don't think they care at the New York Post.
Yeah.
I think their standards are different from other places.
Well, that's a shame.
It's a shame.
But they do sell 500,000 papers, right?
No, I don't think it's
maybe
that many.
300 at this point. I don't know. I wouldn't say 500 anymore.
But as you say, a lot of eyeballs are on there.
A lot of eyeballs, yep. And they might probably make a little bit of money for Mr. Murdoch.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, maybe you think they lose still.
Yeah, I think
so. Mm-hmm. Well, one little thing. We talk often about freedom of information laws on this program, and it is important to note that the crisis in Flint, Michigan, that now we are paying so much attention to, the dirty water that has been sickening and probably has permanently damaged many children, that we might have known more about if Michigan had a freedom of information law like other states. Michigan is one of only two states in the country. The other is Massachusetts, where many people listen to this program, where the State Freedom of Information Act excludes the governor's office from public record searches.
That's just wrong.
So if you want to know something about what's going on in Governor Charlie Baker's office in Massachusetts, you can't use the Freedom of Information Act.
Yeah.
He's exempt.
That's just wrong.
Yep, it is. And
as a Massachusetts resident, I want you to know how much I resent that.
Absolutely. And think about what may be happening in Massachusetts that you don't know about the same way in Michigan. Folks didn't find out about what's going on under the Freedom of Information Law in Flint. So hope that something like that doesn't occur in the Commonwealth, as they say. Right?
Right.
Next
week's show, maybe we'll define the difference between a Commonwealth and a state. That would help us all. That's the Media Project for another week. Dr. Shartok, it's wonderful to see you as always, Mr. Fussfeld, Publisher Fussfeld, and I'm Editor Smith, the professor, the publisher, and the editor. Thank you for joining us on the Media Project.
And thank you, Rex, for showing up and doing such a good job.
Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people.
Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Full or part-time options, 518-454-5143.
It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.